Good evening and welcome to Peace Talk, a production for KTOO Radio's Focus on Community.
Once some guy went so far to say, try to imagine no heaven, no hell, and no God. No king, no country, not even possessions. We all thought he was asking a lie. So we kept on fighting for all of this stuff. But it never turned out to be reason enough to justify losing people we love. Yeah, that's what we did before the end of war. The end of war.
Peace Talk is a monthly program produced by the Juneau Chapter of Veterans for Peace. It's VFP's contribution to our community's ongoing conversation about war and peace and the important issues and questions they raise in our society and around the world. Joining me tonight is Johnny Elliott, a soon-to-be graduate of JDHS and this year's VFP scholarship winner. We'll be discussing his essay about Oliver's Army, a song written and performed by Elvis Costello. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the nuclear deal between the P5 nations plus one, which is the U.S., Britain, France, Russia, China, and the plus one is Germany and Iran, and then revisit the past for a few minutes by discussing the fall of Saigon, which happened 40 years ago last month and brought America's military involvement in the Vietnam War to an end. Iran. So for those of you who listened to our show, our last show, you might recall that I interviewed Paul Pillar, who had a 28-year career in America's intelligence agencies. And he now works as a security studies program faculty member and researcher at Georgetown University. Paul succinctly described the deal the Obama administration will likely present to Congress as better than the alternative. I recorded the interview the same day the Juneau Empire published my column criticizing U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan about the deal. Sullivan had written, was one of the 47 Republican senators who signed on to a letter that was sent to Iran, and he had been criticizing the administration for not wanting to bring the deal to Congress. I criticized Sullivan and basically suggested that wasn't his main intent of signing on to that letter, that he was also trying to scuttle the deal. The junior senator, a week later, or a few days after my peace talk, he replied to my opinion piece in the Empire with his own opinion piece. And I've been asked why I didn't respond to him by several people in the community in my last column, or last few weeks. Well, I want to let you know, I wasn't conceding the last word to Sullivan by not responding. The deal will still be a story come this summer. I'll be watching the senator closely, especially when the debate reaches Congress. I do disagree with a lot of what he wrote. In particular, I don't think he I think he took my piece out of context by stating that I didn't represent the facts, because I didn't pretend to represent facts. I was questioning his facts as not being factual at all. And I also didn't take kindly to the suggestion that he felt that I was representing or defending the Iranian regime when I was defending the process of diplomacy over his actions and trying to, what I believe, again, was to scuttle the deal. If he doesn't support the deal, I'll be all over him for pretending what his reasons were for signing on to that letter. And personally, I think Senator Sullivan hasn't been sincere on this issue with us. Like Pillar told us, he admired the letter's author, Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, for having the ability to be honest about why he wrote it. Cotton is on the record as saying he wants to prevent a deal. Sullivan doesn't have the courage to admit that. Another point Pillar made is America seemed to need a boogeyman. We love having an enemy to hate. It was Russia till the end of the Cold War. Iran's filled that role more than a few times since 1979. When they took the hostages in the embassy at near the end of Carter's administration. Sullivan's piece in the Empire suggested that's what he's playing to. And let's not forget, this is a guy who spent 2.5 years working for President Bush as Assistant Secretary of State for Economic and Business Affairs. This is the same Bush who put Iran in the axis of evil, invaded Iraq, and might have bombed Iran had not the military brass stood up against him. But Pillar's main point is that this deal is the best we're going to see. No deal means no inspectors in Iran doing extra duty to ensure the nuclear activity is for peaceful purposes. No deal means Iran's next election will bring back a hard-line government. Our European allies will blame America if the deal falls apart, and no deal means the likelihood of war goes up. Now, I know I didn't support Mark Baggage in his re-election bid. I regret that to some degree, but sadly, the former senator didn't trust Iran or the administration on this issue either. Baggage was afraid of upsetting the American-Israeli Public Action Committee, just like he was afraid of the National Rifle Association. Sullivan isn't afraid of either lobby. He agrees with him, which makes him a lousy senator, in my opinion, in a different way. But enough about Sullivan and Iran. Let's turn the clock back 40 years. On April 30th, 1975, our military completed an evacuation of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. It was a moment of extreme embarrassment for our government that had prosecuted an unjust war against the North Vietnamese for more than a decade. We should have been humiliated more by the moral bankruptcy of bombing 2 to 3 million civilians to their graves. And we never should have let our military command reestablish its reputation as a force behind a peace-loving nation. A week earlier, President Gerald Ford, the man who inherited the war after Nixon's resignation, gave a speech at Tulane University in Louisiana, in which he acknowledged America's defeat and humiliation. Let's listen to selected excerpts of his speech.
On January 8, 1815, a monumental American victory was achieved here, the Battle of New Orleans. Louisiana had been a state for less than 3 years, but outnumbered Americans innovated, outnumbered Americans used the tactics of the frontier to defeat a veteran British force trained in the strategy of the Napoleonic Wars. We as a nation had suffered humiliation and a measure of defeat in the War of 1812. Our national capital in Washington had been captured and burned. So the illustrious victory in the Battle of New Orleans was a powerful restorative to our national pride. Yet the victory at New Orleans took place 2 weeks after the signing of the armistice in Europe. Thousands died, although a peace had been negotiated. The combatants had not gotten the word. Yet the epic struggle nevertheless restored America's pride. Today, America can regain the sense of pride that existed before Vietnam. But it cannot be achieved by refighting a war that is finished as far as America is concerned. As I see it, the time has come to look forward to an agenda for the future, to unify, to bind up the nation's wounds, and to restore its health and its optimistic self-confidence. We can begin a great national reconciliation. I ask that we stop refighting the battles and the recriminations of the past. I ask that we look now at what is right with America. I ask that we accept the responsibility of leadership as a good neighbor to all peoples and an enemy of none. I ask that we strive to become, in the finest American tradition, something more tomorrow than we are today. We, of course, are saddened indeed by the events in Indochina. But these events, tragic as they are, portend neither the end of the world nor of America's leadership in the world. Now, let me put it this way, if I might. Some tend to feel that if we do not succeed in everything, everywhere, then we have succeeded in nothing, anywhere. I reject categorically such polarized thinking. We must now move beyond the discords of the past decade. It is in this spirit that I ask you to join me in writing an agenda for the future. I welcome your invitation, particularly tonight, because I know it is at Tulane and other centers of thought throughout our great country that much consideration is being given to the kind of future Americans want, and just as importantly, will work for. Each of you are preparing yourselves for the future. And I'm deeply interested in your preparations and your opinions and your goals. However, tonight, with your indulgence, let me share with you my own views. I envision a creative program that goes as far as our courage and our capacities can take us, both at home and abroad. My goal is for a cooperative world at peace, using its resources to build, not to destroy.
So that was President Gerald Ford speaking a week before the evacuation of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. And he used a lesson from our distant past to suggest that we shouldn't revise our history to erase our humiliations, that no nation is perfect, and it was time to move on and work towards peace in the future. That was before the evacuation, though, from the embassy, and which really made the fiasco even more of a humiliation. How bad was it that last day? Sandy Gall, a Scottish journalist for the British-based ITN News, was there, and he described it like this.
American embassy officials had promised an orderly evacuation for their own people, the foreign press, and for all those Vietnamese who had worked for them and might be in danger. The plan was for a helicopter evacuation from the embassy grounds, and the signal was Bing Crosby singing White Christmas over Radio Saigon. But somebody forgot to play it, and the embassy was stormed. So people fought and clawed their way over that wall, and they did fight and they did claw. The hysteria was infectious. From midday to past midnight, a constant shuttle of naval helicopters from the American 7th Fleet airlifted out of that embassy more than 5,000 people. The ambassador went on the final helicopter from the platform above his office. He was the last American to leave Vietnam.
There's no erasing that as an exclamation point to the nation's humiliation. And, after decades of blood and treasure wasted in Vietnam, it's part of our history and will forever be part of our history. And the hysteria Gall saw and reported on became theatrical history, too, as depicted in this piece from the 1989 Theater Royal and Broadway musical, Miss Saigon.
Sorry, Sergeant, we must accelerate. State Department says we evacuate. The word is we must be out by dawn.
This straight from Washington, no one leaves the grounds now. Not anyone as fast as we load the planes, we're gone.
But my girl's up there!
Okay, keep quiet, don't shout. The
ambassador won't leave till everyone's out. The choppers on the way have room for you all.
They're climbing over the wall. Get back!
Get back, I tell you, don't shout. The ambassador will leave till everyone's out.
Let me out, I have to go back for my bride!
This is someone, my husband is waiting inside.
Please, Kim, hear the phone. I can't get there, please be home.
The ambassador's leaving now.
Take it with you.
Take my children.
I will be handled.
My house
is behind him. The people will be by him. Don't leave us behind him.
I have a wife who's left already.
I have a love in New York.
I have no one to say.
There is no one to find him. They have left us behind him.
I must get in there and listen anyone. Before my husband, look, I have his gun.
That's
all that you've got.
If I am here when they come, I'll be shot.
Let me go, John, I can't leave her. Why in the world should I be saved instead of her?
The hell will it find him. Don't leave us behind him.
It's a view, it's war that's cruel. And if the dream gets mad, perhaps it's best they were.
There is no one to find him. They have left us behind him.
Wake up, my friend, your mercy trip has failed. There's nothing you can do, the ship has sailed.
She's not the only one we'll have betrayed.
Get to the roof or else we are betrayed.
So even in the theater, the fall of Saigon was portrayed as a desperate event. People were betrayed by America, losing the war in Vietnam, and the evacuation from Saigon should not be remembered for the humiliation the country felt at the time, but for the reminder that unjust wars everywhere and anywhere must, at all costs, be avoided. The fall of Saigon is not just a history lesson in humiliation. It's one of responsibility. As Ford said at Tulane, he wanted not to refight the war through revisionist history, but to begin a period of national reconciliation. The fate of our future is not just what we decide we want it to be, but what we're willing to work for. And if that vision of peace he described is truly what we want, then we as peacemakers must always be on the job. We are the check and balance of our government and especially of the imperial-minded warhawks in Congress. And if we are to learn from the past, we must guard its truths, which means it's our job to make sure that the history we teach future generations isn't sanitized to make America look exceptional in the eyes of the generations to come. And that's what the Pentagon has taken as their charge to commemorate the Vietnam War. And it's what VFP's full disclosure program is all about. As Ford said, we didn't succeed in Vietnam. We not only failed to win the war, but we failed long before to build a peace there. We failed to honor the Vietnamese desire for self-determination. And as Daniel Ellsberg describes in his memoir titled Secrets, America's leadership failed to admit to the nation from the beginning through successive presidential administrations of Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, the war was fought so not to saddle their legacies with failure. And that's true about the Vietnam, as much true about the Vietnam War as it is about the Iraq War. The reason why President Obama chose not to investigate Bush's push to invade Iraq on false pretenses, or his illegal torture of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, is, I believe, because he expects his predecessors to do the same to protect his legacy. Now, before Johnny Elliott joins us, I want to remind you, you've been listening to Peace Talk on KTOO-FM in Juneau, And as I said at the beginning of the show, Johnny is the winner of VFP's annual scholarship competition that's open to all graduating seniors from high schools in Juneau and around Southeast Alaska. This is one of VFP's efforts to plant the seeds of peacemaking into the hearts and minds of our youth. Congratulations, Johnny, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you decided to enter this competition for a scholarship. Tell us where you what your plans are for college, where you're going to school, and what you plan on studying.
Yeah, next year I'm heading off to Dartmouth College, all the way over in New Hampshire. Yeah, it'll be pretty far from here. It'll be nice to still get some snow, get some seasons. And, yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I'm thinking of majoring within science. I don't really know where yet. I'm going to try out some stuff. I don't have to declare till sophomore year. And I figure anyone who makes a plan is probably going to change it anyway. So.
Yeah, that's a good point. My son, when he came back from Iraq the third time, he had planned on staying in the military 20 years. And he said to me, he says, Dad, he says, the Greeks used to say if you wanted to make the gods laugh, you tell them your plans because they'll change them. And that's what happened to him. And most people I know didn't stay with their majors, whatever they start out in college. A lot of people change. It's with what we teach you in high school and how we get you prepared, you got a lot more learning to do before you know what you're going to really want to do. So, but Dartmouth is a great place. I've got a good friend that lives there, and I grew up in New England, and it's a great school.
Nice. Yeah, I'm super excited, like I said. Yeah. And I know a girl who goes to Thunder Mountain who's going to be there too, so I'm not totally alone. It's from Juneau.
How do your parents feel about you going across the country?
I think they were kind of expecting it. I mean, I applied to 6 different schools, 2 on the West Coast, 3 on the East Coast, 1 sort of in the middle. And so odds were that I was going to head over there. And they took me on a college tour over there last March of my junior year. So my dad went to college on the East Coast. My mom went to college in Canada, also East Coast area. They're familiar with the area. And yeah.
Well, let's talk about this scholarship competition. This is the 4th year we've done it based upon music. And I thought what we would do for the audience is read the assignment that we gave to the students and the seniors. And to begin with, the assignment begins with the opening song verses from Emmanuel Jal's song, We Want Peace. Let's listen to that, and then we'll go through the rest of this.
Oh, yeah, I'm looking for some people who's looking for peace. Maybe together we could make the war cease. Now we can send mankind to the moon, and we can reach to the bottom of the sea. That's why it really kind of baffles me that we cannot end wars and bring peace. That's why I am. I'm calling on the whole wide world. Come on, people, would you help me?
America has been at war since the class of 2015 was in elementary school. But just like your parents and most citizens of our country, most of you will never know what it means to be on the front lines or caught in the crossfire between armed soldiers. We're fortunate in that regard. But does that mean we should support America's wars in other lands without ever thinking about the havoc it wrecks on the soldiers or the innocent civilians just like you and your family? Emmanuel Jal wasn't as lucky as you. At a time when he should have been in elementary school, he became a soldier fighting for the Sudan's People Liberation Army in that country's second civil war. For 5 years, he saw war's brutality, its futility, its stupidity, and those are words spoken by General Dwight D. Eisenhower, the supreme commander of the Allied forces in World War II and America's 34th president. That's why Jal is asking the whole wide world to stand up and scream for peace.
To begin to know war, we need to listen to people like Jal and Eisenhower. There are also musicians who tell stories on behalf of the combat soldiers they know. In 1983, the Australian folk group Red Gum recorded a song titled I Was Only 19. Songwriter John Schumann writes that it was based on details provided by my mate and brother-in-law, who was brave and trusting enough to share his story with me. Do you hear the horror that this soldier brought home from the Vietnam War in these lines from I Was Only 19?
And can you tell me, doctor, why I still can't get to sleep? The night time's just a jungle dark and a barking M16. And what's this rash that comes and goes? Can you tell me what it means? God help me. I was only 19.
Just a naive boy from Austin, thought that war was just a game. After my first day out in Baghdad, I could only hang my head in shame. Saw a little girl stranded in the street. A bullet took her down before I could reach my feet. Just bring me home.
In the U.S. Navy during the first Gulf War, he wrote his song Bring Me Home while he was an active member of the Juno chapter of Veterans for Peace. It was recorded in the kitchen at the home of Juno singer-songwriter Pat Henry, one of 15 songs protesting the war in Iraq that were performed by Juno musicians for the VFP-produced CD in 2006 titled Wounded Dove.
Now, there are hundreds of songs written from a passionate desire to end war and build a more just and peaceful world. Our task to these students was to listen to any of the selections that we gave them, or a song of their choosing, and compose an essay that describes the story you believe the songwriter is trying to convey. How does it affect your personal views about war, and tell us if it helps you appreciate why Emmanuel Jal is asking the world to stand up and scream for peace. So, Johnny, you picked a song from Elvis Costello that was written after the Vietnam War ended a few years later. Do you want to tell us why you found that song that led you to it?
The song I picked was it was called Oliver's Army, and it's a song that I've heard since I was probably in like third grade. It was on my mom's iPod, and I decided to, when I was younger, to like go through all the songs. I decided it was a catchy song, and back then I knew all the words before I really knew what they meant. When I had just passed my driver's test, I was driving around, and I found a CD in my car, and it was an Elvis Costello CD, and this was the first song that came on. And now I was old enough to kind of get the difference between hearing music and listening to music, and I was like, oh, wow, this is – and, of course, I had the Veterans for Peace prompt just running around in my mind, and I was like, wow, this is a perfect song, so – I decided, and the lyrics came back to me, and I had to look them up to make sure I was right. Elvis Costello is a bit of a mumbler. then I wrote the essay, that's how it came to me.
So you just got your driver's license after the VFP announced the scholarship, and you were aware of that the day that you listened to this?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that made it easy for you. Did you listen to any other songs? Did you explore any other music before you decided to do this one?
I was kind of thinking of some songs in my head. I really like the song Imagine by John Lennon. A song we listened to earlier kind of alluded to it. I don't know. This one kind of hit me in a different way. You know? I mean, the other song, it's really good and all, and I love it. I don't know. It seemed this one felt a little different for me, and we'd also done an Imagine analysis project in lit class already, so I wanted to be a little more original.
Well, the Imagine reference that you referred to was in the theme to the to Peace Talk, which is a song called The End of War, written by Eric Colville from Massachusetts. He won an award for that. He allowed us to use it to pull pieces out of it and use it as our theme music. And partly what happened the piece we learned to listen to tonight is that he is referring to John Lennon. I had written an essay for the Whale Song at the University of Alaska to promote a peace and reconciliation conference that went on there, I think back in 2008 or 2009. And the essay was around this end of war song. And Eric Colville had written that song. He was inspired by the Lorax, of all things. He was reading the Lorax to his young son, and he didn't like the way it ended, where the forest was all gone. And, you know, we were in the middle of the Iraq War at the time, and he wanted to come up with a story, or he had a dream that he would be able to tell his son that war was all over, instead of war root, you know, wiped us out like the Lorax wiped out the forests, you know, or not the Lorax, but whoever the villain is in that book. But he wanted the wars to be gone. So that the end of war is about him he's telling his grandchild that there is no more wars. And his grandchild's asking him, like you might be asking us old folks in here, what is war? I don't know anything about war. So he's explaining it was all gone. So, yeah, he was inspired by Lennon to create a unique interpretation of Lennon's work and his own and Dr. Seuss. So let's why don't we listen to Elvis Costello's, what's the song?
It's called Oliver's Army.
Why don't we listen to that again, and then you can read the essay.
Sleepwalking while I'm putting the world to right. How could you?
So that was Elvis Costello and singing All of His Army, which is the theme song for Johnny's award-winning essay. And he's going to read this to us now.
All right. Thanks, Rich. Elvis Costello wrote the song All of His Army in 1978 based on two observations. Unemployment in England was high, and boys were being recruited into the military to give them jobs. Costello argues that the English government was seeking out war and recruiting kids to fight in order to lower unemployment statistics. Don't start me talking, I could talk all night. My mind goes sleepwalking while I'm putting the world to right. Called careers, information, have you got yourself an occupation? In that first verse, Costello starts by acknowledging that war is not confined to one simple problem that can fully be addressed in a 3.5-minute song. He, like many of us, could ramble on and on and on about the terrible truths of war. The ending of the verse is probably my favorite line of the song. Have you got yourself an occupation is a pun. In one interpretation, the line is spoken by a boy who's being targeted as a recruit for the military. The boy is being asked to consider the military as a career. In the other interpretation, the line refers to military occupations of foreign countries, and is asked to a military leader. The double meaning in this line shows that generals and commanders feel pressure to invade and claim territory to the same extent that youths feel pressure to get a job. Then begins the chorus. Oliver's army is here to stay. Oliver's army is on their way, and I would rather be anywhere else but here today. This repeated chorus is meant to emphasize that many of the recruited soldiers faced the battlefield and realized that this was the last thing they wanted. Their government had urged them to join the fight with words like duty and hero, but the brutality of the battlefield and the proximity to death rang louder once they were faced with war's reality. I should also mention here that I discovered that Oliver is believed to be a reference to Oliver Cromwell, whose formidable army is considered to be the root of all British armies. Then the next verse goes, there was a checkpoint, Charlie. He didn't crack a smile, but it's no laughing party when you've been on the murder mile. Only takes one itchy trigger, one more widow, one less. Well, you heard the song. I'm not going to say that over the radio. This second verse revisits the bitter realities of war. It alludes to the Cold War with Checkpoint Charlie, a station of the Berlin Wall dividing East and West Germany, and the troubles of Northern Ireland with the Murder Mile, a treacherous street in Belfast where Costello visited and became inspired to write the song. He warns the listener that neither is a laughing matter, for every single bullet shot had the potential to kill a man and widow his wife. After another chorus, Oliver's army runs to the following bridge. Hong Kong is up for grabs. London is full of Arabs. We could be in Palestine, overrun by the Chinese line, with the boys from the Mersey and the Thames and the Tyne. Costello is paraphrasing the thoughts of English military leaders. He sees them as looking for war somewhere, hunting it out when there is little to no rationale. The line at the end revisits Costello's central theme that the working-class boys are doing the killing and that they are being recruited to, quote-unquote, solve unemployment. The Mersey, Thames, and Tyne are three rivers in Europe that run through the metropolitan areas of Liverpool, London, and Newcastle, respectively. When the song was written, these were areas of high unemployment. Costello is saying that boys from these impoverished areas will be doing the killing and dying. Then the song goes into its final verse. But there's no danger. It's a professional career, though it could be arranged with just a word in Mr. Churchill's ear. If you're out of luck and you're out of work, we could send you to Johannesburg. The first two lines of this final verse are sly recruitment tactics spoken by a recruiter to a recruit, urging him to consider the military as a potential career and significantly downplaying the dangers. The next two lines explain how easily wars can be started and boys can be sent to their death. Mr. Churchill is a reference to Winston Churchill, the English Prime Minister during World War II, responsible for war strategy. These lines criticize the relative ease with which one man can order troops into combat. The last two lines hammer home the point of the whole song. The English government was sending working-class boys to kill and die in faraway lands because it was an easy way to mitigate high unemployment. I listened to Oliver's Army when I was little and simply liked the tune. As I grew up and my musical preferences morphed, I lost touch with the song. Nevertheless, I became reacquainted with it this year, and when I could finally appreciate its meaning. It means much more to me now. Although the song was written in the late 70s about England, its argument remains relevant today. In America, we have an outrageously high military budget compared to the rest of the world, yet we do not even have a war in our home country. Over the past century, we had gotten involved in countless wars overseas and sent an atrociously high number of kids into the mayhem. I have friends who want to join the Marines and the Air Force, and I worry about them, because they're intelligent and fun and have potential outside the military. However, at some point, some advertisement or something convinced them that they need to join the military for their country. Oliver's Army criticizes the military for putting these kids in the position, in that position, and for that I support and commend it.
Well, thank you. That was great.
Thank you.
It was a good song to pick. I've got several questions I want to ask you in particular.
Sure.
Things that you referenced, things that I wouldn't have heard in the song unless I listened to it more than once. But it's about recruits. Did you ever get meet with a recruiter from the military at GDHS?
Not really. Whenever we have college fairs, there are a bunch of branches of the military that are there, also alongside. Not really my thing to go up and talk to them about it, but it is for a lot of kids.
Yeah, the military recruiters used to be in the high schools much more often prior to the wind down of the Iraq War. In the 2006. Veterans for Peace actually had a program called Southeast Alaska Truth and Recruiting, CEDAR, which is no longer active because the recruiters pretty much are only showing up on Career Day. But we used to have members at Career Day just to expose the students to other possibilities to serve their country, as well as to explain to them, you know, certain areas that they might do a little more searching to find out what enlisting really means.
Mm-hmm.
Now, during the Iraq War, which was pretty much over before you got into high school, I mean, President Obama pulled the final troops out in 2012. That must have been right when you were a freshman, I guess.
Yeah, I entered high school in 2011. 2012 would have been spring of my freshman year.
So the recruitment efforts have been way down. But in Vietnam, which we talked about earlier, recruitment wasn't the same type of an issue. Do you know how soldiers were sent to Vietnam?
I mean, you had the draft,
right?
And conscription,
yeah.
And all that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people who believe that without the draft, that the nation was a lot more willing to go to war with a volunteer, professional army, rather than spreading the pain around the countryside to every family, potentially, anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I missed the draft by a year. I turned 17 just 2 weeks, I think, before the draft was closed. I still had to register. I had a brother who missed it, having to register for the draft by 2 weeks. I never was subjected to that. But a lot of the people who served in Vietnam, most of them were there because of the draft, and this, you know, Oliver's Army doesn't really speak to that, but the horrors that the soldiers face on both ends are the same, which is another thing you pointed out, and it's what we began the program with, referring to a couple of the songs that talked about soldiers' horrors in war, and you also mentioned in your essay that we have a big budget, we don't have any wars at home. You know, the other people who suffer from war are civilians in the countries where we're at war.
Right.
You know, what kind of studying did you do in school that exposed you to what soldiers actually experience or to what civilians experience in war?
Well, I think the most powerful experience I had with that in school is that junior year, I was in an AP Lion class, and as far as I know, every AP Lang class also reads this book. It's called The Things They Carried.
Oh, yeah, Tim O'Brien. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And he has a very unique style in this book, and he tells it as though it were a memoir, but he also gives a chapter explaining how to tell a true war story. And he explains that a true war story is really not – doesn't mean that the facts are true, but that it can get across the feeling to someone who hasn't been in a war. And he openly admits that that he purposely exaggerates it because otherwise you wouldn't really understand reading it how horrific it is to be on the front lines and all that.
Yeah, I'd say he gives it literary flair.
Right. Yeah, that's
readable,
that's a
better interesting,
word.
And rather than getting down to the nitty gritty and every pin, you know, point out everything that actually happened, he makes it very readable, very understandable, and he imparts the feelings that he experienced.
And he does it not just on the battlefield, but also when he gets home, and he has a very vivid chapter about him just driving around a lake. Not really feeling much purpose.
Yeah, not knowing what he was supposed to do now that he was back, which a lot of Vietnam veterans suffered from, a lack of, and the same thing, the Iraq War veterans, many of them have come home disillusioned as well, and America throws parades for soldiers returning and troops. I was at my son's return from Iraq, his second deployment there, you know, it was a big celebration up in Fairbanks. But when they get back, they still don't want to talk about the stories. They still don't feel a purpose, especially after they get out and they've lost that band of brothers that they were while they were over there. You know, you also mentioned, you know, other places in the world. Northern Ireland was referenced in the song. You know, what's your experience or, you know, how much do you know about what went on in Northern Ireland?
I mean, you had like the IRA and the whole like war that was going on there, and I think it was in my world history class. Most people take it as a sophomore. I had it freshman year. We read a thing about two snipers on opposite sides of buildings in like Belfast or somewhere that were. There was about that time period, and it was it took me.
Well, it's good
powerful.
To know you got teachers teaching this type of stuff in school. That's encouraging.
Yeah.
It really is.
Just something to say about my American history class was that most of the year is spent rather than getting into the history book is. Learning historiography and really learning how to question the history book and get multiple points of view from it. And I think to some extent, I can't confirm this, but that our teacher didn't want us reading the history book in the way that the history book was written. We start the year with a great assignment where we watch the movie Pocahontas. And then we have to go out and research, well, what do you think really happened? And as it turns out, you get into the research of there's just polar opposite takes of how the story really went. And there aren't a lot of primary sources. Even John Smith himself has two different takes of it, one 20 years after the other. And there's so many different things, and you have to learn to kind of see the whole picture and incorporate it all into one thing. And so when we got into reading about World War II, our final in the class was looking at how the book portrays World War II and comparing that to looking at author's bias and looking at other things to really just get us thinking for ourselves.
Well, that's good. Any historian knows that history is subject to interpretation, and rather than the history books in school that I remember stuck to for the most part to the facts, the big storyline, and the so-called facts and the big storyline, rather than you know ask us to interpret things. We got tested on them. We hear a lot about students taking, you know. Test for certain subjects. I do understand, though, that history is not subjected to standardized testing, which is a good thing because you can't standardize answers for this type of thing. You know, one of the things about the Irish Republican Army and the Northern Ireland British battle is that it's a lesson for us that you can't – the way to end terrorism is to negotiate a peace. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what happened in Northern Ireland. You know, after years of it was a struggle similar to, Israel and Palestine to some degree. It was, the Irish considered they wanted their country back. Basically, they didn't like being dominated by the island across the sea. And there was a lot of terrorism. There was a lot of military brutality. And they both fed each other. And the resolution of all that was a peace negotiation, you know. And here we are still, 14 years after 9/11, thinking we're going to destroy, wipe out every terrorist, you know, every bad person in the world. You know, we haven't learned that lesson. So, what anything else you want to add to what you got out of the assignment in terms of, did this help you think in terms of listening to music? I mean, it doesn't sound like it did. It sounds like you always paid attention to music.
Yeah. Music's just a very powerful medium for transmitting these messages. I mean, something about the tones and the emotion that singers put into their voice and all of that just combines into a really great effect for really putting across a message. And hearing all these songs about peace, you can really tell that the singers are passionate about this, and it can resonate with you so well through music, those messages.
Well, and I think what we're going to do with the time we've got left, we're going to play one more song. It's by a group, I think it's called Chico, is that right? You may know it. And I'm picking this song because I think it's a younger generation song, and I'm hoping there's younger people listening since you're on the show tonight. Otherwise, I would go with the other song we got here, which is Bob Dylan, which predates almost even me. But we're going to listen to this. It's called Papa and the War.
Listen to the voice of reason. Words of wisdom have to be ushered. A better world have to be built. Listen to the voice of reason.
Thank you.
So hearken the voice of reason is exactly what our country needs to do. That's from this song, Papa Stop the War. And Jessica Landry, who picked this, and she was a runner-up in the competition, she asked, how is it possible that we are so advanced, yet wars still persist? One would think that cruel, barbaric nature of war would have ended with prehistoric man. Well, we still seem to have some prehistoric administrators in our governments, I guess, is the only thing I could say. You know, and it's sadly not just other nations. I think, you know, our government is as guilty as others for this. But anyways, you've been listening to Peace Talk on KTOO-FM. Johnny Elliott has been here in the studio with me talking about his award-winning essay for the VFP scholarship this year. He's on his way to Dartmouth, and I just want to say, Johnny, that I'm very impressed with the not just what you wrote, but what you've learned in school, what stuck with you, what you talked to us about tonight. I hope and I do believe it's rooted in your heart somewhere that the day comes that we face other serious wars, you'll be able to mobilize that energy and do good things. And I wish you the very best at Dartmouth.
Thank you so much.
And again, thanks for coming on the show. And with that, we're getting pretty close to wrapping it up for tonight. I have one announcement I want to make, and that's in regard to the YES Exchange Student Exchange Program. Just a little bit of good news in the past few weeks. We've identified three families for next year. We're going to continue the program. Next year will be our fifth year having exchange students from Muslim countries with predominantly Muslim populations. But that's it for tonight. This has been Peace Talk on KTOO. I'm Rich Moniak with John Kremers and Dolly Kremers in the studio doing the engineering. Thank you for joining us, and have a good night.
The end of one.